Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Today's Pashtuns by Kamar Jawaker. This is the fifth lecture in a series entitled A Multidisciplinary Approach to the AFPAC Region and Its People, being hosted by MES at MCU. Since 2007, Mr. Jawaker has been a West South Asia cultural and geopolitical expert at the Marine Corps Center for Advanced Operational Culture Learning at Marine Corps Base Quantico, as well as a contracted interpreter and language instructor, most notably for the U.S. Department of State Foreign Service Institute. From 1996 to 1999, he served as the elected chairman of the board of directors for the Afghan NGOs Coordination Bureau, where he coordinated between Afghan NGOs, international NGOs, UN agencies, Afghan authorities, Pakistani government, and international donors. He also represented Afghan NGOs as the Afghan member of the UN Afghanistan Task Force on issues related to humanitarian assistance for Afghanistan. From 1991 to 1999, Mr. Jawaker was director of the Afghan Development Agency, where he managed humanitarian assistance projects in the sectors of irrigation, agriculture, education, construction, road repair, and drug awareness. This presentation took place Monday, 3 May 2010, from 1400 to 1530 at Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Thank you for joining us on the fifth of a series of lectures that here at the we have at the Marine Corps University's Middle East Studies have held. The series, those of you who have been here, have began with discussing poetry, the role thereof in Pashtun identity and how it worked. We then went on and heard from Robert McChesney on the historical narrative of Afghanistan, how Afghanistan's history was put together. Then we parted away from culture and history into something very modern. We had Ambassador Peter Galbraith. Some of you may know him. He was the number two in the UN before leaving or being let go because of his problems with the elections. So Peter Galbraith gave us his views on what went wrong in Afghanistan today. So we kind of left history and poetry and came to today. Then our fourth speaker, which was right here in this room, we had Professor Hanifi, who discussed a version of the Pashtun history. I think it's not by coincidence that we have Mr. Khamaruddin Jawaker. We have gone a little bit, we have done some nepotism by that Mr. Jawaker actually works here. He works, as you can see, at the Keokal, which is just a few yards away from here. But the reason was not that it was convenient to have somebody right next door. It was because of what he offers to the table. You may hear, those of you who have been here and heard Dr. Hanifi, you may hear a different perspective. And this is the whole idea, because the series, as I always have said, comes in from the directive of General McChrystal in trying to understand the people, and I want to underline that, the people of what we call now the AFPAC or PACAF, depending on what group you come from, of the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. And the people that we collectively, ourselves, ISAF, contributing states, are engaged predominantly are the Pashtuns. You know, there are other people both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. You have the many, many people, but at just the border area of Afghanistan and Pakistan are mostly predominant in the Pashtuns, and therefore we wanted to look at them and offer you something from a person who is a native of Afghanistan and who, in my view, has given the Marines on a operational level a lot of lectures. And I taught, and Adam Seitz, who runs this thing mainly, taught that maybe it would be beneficial for us to hear the same thing here and also juxtapose it with what we have heard from the academic side so far. Another thing that you may or may not be aware of is we are planning to publish a book after all of this is over. So far we already have the first two papers on hand, and Dr. Hanifi is sending his very, very soon. Mr. Jabarkhil has been very kind to also accept to write a paper, and speakers who come after that will also do that. The next one I'll just tell you is will be on 8 June. It will be Ambassador Ron Newman. He was Ambassador of the United States in Afghanistan until 2007, April 2007, and he also will write a paper. So we'll put it all together and then have it for Marines and anybody else to use that. Also, we have CDs of all these talks. These talks are going to be recorded, not video, but actually video too, sorry. Video and audio. I should look good. and they are available both on our website, at the Marine Corps University website. Again, thanks to Adam. And secondly, they are also available if you want. We can send you a CD of any of these talks. Please contact Adam or myself. You'll get a better deal if you contact Adam on that one. And he will send it to you. We have a few on hand right now from the past lectures. I don't know how many we have on hand, but please use these resources. This is for our community here to understand this issue more. Without further ado, Mr. Jabarkhil, thank you for coming and accepting our invitation. Please.
Thank you, Dr. Tadzi. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm an immigrant in the United States of America for almost a decade. And for every immigrant, English is a second language. That's what in the community colleges, they call it ESL. English is ESL for me as well, but not as a second language, as a sixth language. So don't expect the way Dr. Tarzi talked. He's also an African-American. The way he speaks English, so I may not be able to do that. But I will try my best. So if there is any part of my conversation or talk that you don't get it, it's mispronounced, so please let me know. I will try my best to rephrase it and correct myself. Ladies and gentlemen, last month I was here for one reason, actually. I did not want to take some points or some notes from Professor Hanafi's lecture, but I was here to know about the culture of this class. So within an hour, Dr. Tarzi will be looking at me, and he will be giving me the sign to stop. Because now from that class, I understood that I have only 1 hour. So therefore, the presentation I put together is not in details. We are just covering information about Pashtuns in general. There are more than 400 tribes and sub-tribes in Pashtun ethnic group. So in 1 hour, if you are counting from 1 to 400, like a person like me in English, I think that I will not be able to count that in one hour. So, but anyway, we will try our best to do it, to finish it within an hour. And this is the culture, this is the history of the Afghans, especially the Pashtuns. When they are talking, they start from Alexander the Great, always. So when they get to the point, so 70% of the time is spent on the background, and then 30% they will talk on the topic, whatever the subject is. So that will happen today again. Okay. There are different theories about Pashtuns. Last month we heard here that all Afghans and Pashtuns are Aryans. But meantime we heard from that they are Afghania. Actually the word Afghania, it's not Afghania, it's Afaghina, that we are going to talk about that, where that word or where that term Afaghina comes from, and then gradually that changes to Afghan or Afghania. Pashtuns are the first theory, or the strongest theory, which was written by Niamatullah Harawi, who was the historians of Jahangir Mughal king. He wrote in his book, which is called Makhzanul Afghania, or the storage of Afghania or Afghans. He said that Pashtuns are Bani Israel or Israelites. And the way he put together, and that was the first time. And after that, that theory was confirmed by most of the scholars, anthropologists, who were experts about the Pashtuns and the Afghans, and that has been confirmed. So that's why we consider that theory the most important theory, and we believe on that. And there are some legitimate reasons to believe on that. The head father of the Pashtuns is considered to be or believed to be King Saul, King of Israel. King Saul, he was the King of Israel before King David. So when he died, and his successor was King David, his two pregnant wives gave birth to two sons. And King David named them Barchia and Armia. So Barchia and Armia were later on, towards end of the or towards the middle of the King David's era, they were appointed. Barchia was appointed as a prime minister, and Armia was appointed as a head of the army for King David. And Barchia and Armia, both of them had sons. Barchia's son was Asaph, and Armia's son was Afagina. That's why the word Afghan comes from. There is a theory that Afagina had 40 sons and Barchia had 18 sons. So gradually their numbers were increased, and the same way, when after King David, King Solomon appointed Afagina is a head of the army, and King Asaph is a prime minister. So they were working for him. And what we believe, what we the Pashtun believe, is that the building of the holy place was also built by Afagina. And that was, and he completed the building in Jerusalem during his lifetime. After King Solomon, when King of, we call it Bahnasar or Nabunasar, King of the Babylon, when he came to that area, to the Jerusalem area, he killed some of the Israelites, he killed, arrested some of them, and a number of them escaped and they migrated to different locations. One location was Hijaz, the mountains around Mecca, today's Saudi Arabia, and another location was Ghor, one of the provinces of today's Afghanistan. So the group or the Israelites or the Bani Israelites or Israelis who migrated to Ghor, they for some time they were living in the Ghor, but gradually they did not limited themselves to the boundaries of the Ghor. So they spread throughout today's Afghanistan, to Ghazni, Kandahar, Kabul, in different parts of the country, in different mountains, wherever there were more water and land and opportunities available. During after the 8th year of the migration, or we call it Hijrat, migration of Prophet Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. On the 8th year of migration, he had a friend, I'm sure all of you know about that, was Khalid bin Walid. Khalid bin Walid was considered to be one of the descendants of these Afagina or Armia who migrated to Mecca, to Saudi Arabia or Hijaz at that time. He sent a letter to the leaders of Ghor, or to the emirs of Ghor, and he invited them to Islam. After reviewing that letter, after receiving that letter and a message, the emirs or the kings or the leaders of Ghor, they decided, their head leader, whose name was Qais, and Qais is actually a Hebrew name, they decided that Qais will go to Saudi Arabia, to Medina, and he will meet with the Islamic leaders there and Prophet Muhammad. And that's what they did, and he went as a head of delegation to Medina. When he was in Medina, he converted to Islam, and he believed in Islam, and here his name was changed. His new name was Abdul Rashid. But still, the history remembers it by the name of Qais Abdul Rashid. So the Qais, which was a Hebrew name, that is always attached to his name. So Qais Abdul Rashid is the head father of Pashtuns, in today's Pashtuns, in what we have in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Qais Abdul Rashid had three sons. that you see the names Sarban, Gurgash, and Beaton. Sarban's confederation is called Sarbanis or Sarbani. Gurgashs are called the same Gurgash by the name of the individual, and Beaton's confederation or descendants are called by Bitanese or Bitani. Again, we have five confederations. So among the five confederations, three confederations which are the direct descendants of Qais Abd al-Rashid, they are called Qaisi Pashtuns, which are these three confederations. But you see the numbers that I just mentioned, that there are more than 400 tribes and clans in Pashtun ethnicity. And these numbers, the statistics or the information is 40 years old. So in the last 40 years, the numbers may have increased, but we don't have a source, or there is no census or survey done so far. But whatever the 400, I believe 408, the total number of 405 or 8, that is based on 40 years before information. And the second two tribes, or second two confederations of Pashtuns, are called Shansabi Pashtuns. Shansabi Pashtuns are not the direct descendants of Qais Abd al-Rashid. They go back, and Afaghan has, they are the descendants, or their genealogy goes to Afaghana, who was who was 35 generations before Qais Abd al-Rashid. But they are under Afaghana's descendants, but not directly under Qais Abd al-Rashid, because they don't share blood with Qais Abd al-Rashid. They are not the children or the descendants of the three sons of Qais Abd al-Rashid. Now, who they are? Matuzi. Matu, we just mentioned before, we have here Bitan, or Bitanese. So Bit, grandfather Bit, or Bitnika, he had a daughter by the name of Matu. Z is, when we are adding the Z, that makes it like Wilson, Dr. Wilson. So one son. And that's why Matu Zi mean Matu sons. Matu was the daughter of King's Beat father. Since Beat was one of the sons of Qais Abd al-Rashid, and they were the tribal leaders, tribal elders, Matu was married to one of the one of the young men who was also belonged to a very prominent family in the Ghor, the Pashtuns in Ghor, whose name was Shah Hussein Ghori, but not in a higher in a status than Beat. So now here we're talking about the status. The reason that the confederation or the tribes are called Matuzi, after the name of their name, after the name of mother, because mother's family was much higher in status than father's family. So nobody talks about Shah Hussein Ghori. Shah Hussein Ghori also, he was a prince of Ghor, but lower in status than Beat in Matu. Matuzi includes two tribes today, or two, which is Ghilzais and Ludis. Ghilzai or Ghilzai was the first son of Matu, and the second son was Ludi, who was called Ibrahim also. His name was Ibrahim, but people were calling him Ludi, sorry. And that's why we have Ludis, and Ludis were ruling in the 15th century on India, and actually the first rulers among the Pashtuns were from Ludis. And then we have Karlanis, 128 tribes and branches. And Karlanis are believed to be somehow from the Sarbanis, from the Sarbans. Here, Khushal Khan Khatik, which Professor Hanifi mentioned last week, that Khushal Khan Khatik for the first time textualized the Pashto language. He is the founder of the Pashto literature. Khushal Khan Khatik was about 500 years ago, but if you go back to the Pashto literature, it's 1300 years ago. 13 centuries ago, literature we have from the father Amir Kharoor. And then we have 800 years ago or 8 centuries ago literature, Pashto literature from the beatniker. But that was his opinion, and this is what I believe and I think. Khushal Khan Khattak also confirmed in his poetry about these five major confederations of Pashtuns. I translated his poetry, but it is very difficult to translate a joke in songs in a different language, so I hope it makes sense to you. But that was the best I could. So, based on that, we have five confederations, three Qaisi and two Shansabi. The Qaisis are Sarbani, Gurgash, Batini, and Shansabis are Matuzi and Karlani. But today we keep talking about Ghilzais and Duranis, especially in the area, in the areas where US armed forces are involved. In the both, in the east, we have the large number of Ghilzais. In the south or southwest, we have huge number of Duranis, including Ghilzais. And for your information, that among I'll talk about it later. Sorry. So now, who is where the Durani comes and where the Ghilzai comes? Okay, Ghilzais are. Let's talk about Ghilzai. Ghilzais are, as I said, one of the sons of Matu was Ghilzai, and later on that was changed to Ghilzai. So that is based on the elder son of Matu, and the youngest son was Ibrahim Lodi. So that's why we call the tribe Lodi. But Lodis are not confederation today. Lodis falls under Ghilzais. Durani is not a tribe. There is no such a tribe that we talk about that talks about Duranis. They are Sarbanis. If we see Ghilzais ruled rule was started from 1700, and that's why from 1700 till 1709 to 1715, Mirwais Hotak was the first head of state, but not a king of Afghanistan, because the country was not named as a country, Afghanistan. And then his sons and other Ghilzais till 1947, till Ahmad Shah Abdali took over as a Durrani, Abdali, part of the Sarbani tribe. The Duranis and the Abdalis. Abdul was one of the grandsons of Sarban. And that is a large number that I'm preparing a paper to Dr. Terzi. In that paper, you will have the details of that genealogy, who is son, who was father, and who was son, and who was grandson. But here, and to make it short, Ahmad Shah Abdali was a general in Nader Afshar's army when he came to Afghanistan after Nader Afshar's in 1947. And Pir Sabir Shah, who was a religious leader in Kandahar, he was the head of the sworn ceremony, and he gave him a title or Durdaran. Durdaran means, it was a prayer for him actually. Durdaran means you may have a long rule. You may have an extended time of ruling on this country. So gradually that Durdaran was changed to Duran. What Ahmad Shah Abdali did, he created or he found a political movement by the name of Duranis. And under that political movement, he brought not all Sarbanis, some Sarbani tribes who were close, who were mostly Zirak tribes, the Zirak branch of the Sarbani tribes, which are six tribes. Originally there were five, but then later on he made some adjustments and modifications to the tribes to weaken some of the tribes to reduce the future resistance of those tribes. But meanwhile, other than the Zirak part of the Sarbani tribes, he embedded or merged some of the Ghilzai tribes also, and some of the Karlanis or Bitini tribes also under the Durani umbrella. So today, we don't, we recognize Duranis as a confederation, because from 1947 for almost more than 200 years, almost 250 years, so sorry, 1747, They are there. And it's a well-recognized confederation. But large number of the, I wouldn't say large number, but there are numbers of Durranis that they're not Durrani, they are Hilzais. For example, we talk in RC South, southern Afghanistan, Mirzai, Alizai, Ishaqzai. These are some of the tribes that whenever we go to the list of the tribes in Helmand province and Kandahar province, we see these names. These are not Zirak tribes. These are not Abdali tribes. These are not Sarbani tribes. These are Hilzi tribes, part of the Durrani Confederation or Durrani, under the Durrani umbrella. So here, Durrani has two branches. Why we talk a lot about Durrani? Because Durranis are the majority of the tribes, or the majority of the RC South population is made up from Durranis. And Durranis are the leaders, historical leaders of Afghanistan. Durrani has two branches. One is Zirak, which includes six tribes. One is Panchpai. So the Panchpai are the tribes who are embedded to the Durrani, or who came detached from other tribes or other confederation, and they came under the Durrani umbrella. But Ziraks are original Abdalis or Sarbani tribes. These are the today's five confederations. Even we don't have Bhutanese names here. Bhutan is not mentioned here. That is somehow out of the list, because we have a new confederation, Durranis. As I said, that Durranis in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns of Afghanistan, they always see Durranis as leaders, because most of the time they ruled. And the name Afghanistan, the modern Afghanistan, is found by Ahmad Shah Durrani or Ahmad Shah Abdali. And after that, since then, most of the time country has been ruled by Durrani Pashtuns. A few times by Ghilzais. One time was the time of the communism. All three out of four presidents of the communist regimes from 1978 till 1992 were Ghilzais. The third one, Babra Karmal, he was considered to be a Ghilzai also, but we don't have enough information of that. And then after that, Mullah Omar was another Ghilzai leader who was in Afghanistan. Today we have two major insurgency going on in Afghanistan. One is Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group, one is Mullah Omar's group, or Taliban. Both insurgent leaders are Ghilzais. On the other hand, the father of the nation, King Zahir Shah, who passed away last year, he's a Durrani, or he was a Durrani, and Hamid Karzai is a Durrani leader. But if we see some of the experts or some of the outsiders are seeing the today's conflict through different windows. They compare today's conflict to 400, 500 years ago. They say that today it is again the conflict of the Durranis in Ghilzais. Because before it was Durrani, Sarbanis and Matuzis, and now they somehow relate today's conflict to that conflict. But ladies and gentlemen, I personally don't believe on that, because neither communists were based on the ethnicism or ethnicity or tribalism. They had their own communist ideology or the way of doing business, because they were the followers of Lenin, Stalin, and Brezhnev. It was very clear. Nor the today two insurgents, because Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was one of the biggest, he was the biggest fighting faction leaders among the Peshawar seven leaders who were fighting with former Soviet Union, the leaders of the Charlie Wilson's war. He comes from International Islamic Brotherhood. He believes, or he's based on that ideology and mentality. And then Mullah Omar, who is originally coming from the Deoband school. Deoband school is the academic center of the Islamic world in India, but heavily influenced by Al-Qaeda. He's part of Al-Qaeda. His movement, none of these two insurgents leaders while they were in power and today, they never said anything that their movements are based on Pashtun Wali or Pashtun Code of Honor, or they fight for Pashtuns, or they're based on the tribalism, sorry, or Ghilzai, or they're opposing Duranis. They always say, they always believe that we are fighting for Islam and there are no boundaries in Islam. So today's conflict is not based on tribalism or based on confederations. The relationships, this may come a question to your mind that why some of the tribes embedded with Duranis? Why the tribes, why Durrani Confederation was created? Why Mirzai, Atsakzai, Isakzai are considered today Durrani tribes? These are the four major points for the relationships between the Pashtuns. So you have it and you read it. But the most important thing is the genealogy ones, which share the blood. Relationships by marriages, they are bringing people together. Political and social relationships, and invading tribes from one tribe to other tribe, from while they are going from one area to the other area, always the smaller tribes will somehow merge or embed with the bigger tribes. These are accepted phenomena and concepts for relationships and affiliations. In addition to the Pashtuns in Afghanistan, Afghanistan has no clear number, but around 30 million more or less population, with about 40 ethnic groups. Pashtuns majority, Tajiks number two, Hazaras number three, Uzbeks and Nuristanis there. Four and five, and then all together about 40. Even we have Kurds in Afghanistan. But Pashtuns only in Pakistan are much more than the total population of Afghanistan. There is no credible or reliable source that we can get the exact numbers. But total number of the Pashtuns in Afghanistan and Pakistan are the figure that we went through it from 40 million to 61 million. So, huge difference. But in between 40 and, if you consider 40 too low and 61 too high, we will go with the mid. It will be about 50 million people on the both sides of the dividing line, in Pakistan and Afghanistan. In Pakistan, we have seven federally administered tribal areas, which are still ruled, which are not constitutionalized. These seven tribal areas, the system of them is that the still Malik system, tribal system, and one Pakistani bureaucrat, officer, 18 grade officer, is head of the whole district. They call it agency, political agencies. And that one individual, 6 days a week, he is a political agent or he is the governor of that region. One day a week, which is usually Wednesday, he is the judge. He runs a court. So they do not have courts, they do not have police forces. They have tribal militia, and that one individual is in charge of the district. And the funds come through that to that individual from two sources, from the federal government of Pakistan and local revenues. There is no aided process. He is wholly in charge, whatever he does, as long as he keeps law and order in the region. Other than that, we have Pashtuns in Baluchistan. Baluchistan is one of the fourth provinces of Pakistan. We have Baluch, we have Pashtuns, half-half both. And we have Khyber Pashtunkhwa. Khyber Pashtunkhwa is the new name of NWFP, Northwest Frontier Province. And Northwest Frontier Province, the Pashtuns in Northwest Frontier Province were seeking for having their own name, Pashtunkhwa, since 1947. Since the formation of Pakistan. But finally, they managed to have their own name with a combination of two names, actually, Khyber Pashtunkhwa. Khyber is one of the Fatah's agencies, also the tribal agencies. And NWFP was Northwest Frontier Province of Pakistan, but the Pashtuns in Pakistan, how what they were calling NWP was name wanted for province. We have Punjab in Karachi. Punjab has hundreds of thousands of Pashtuns. And these Pashtuns in Punjab are economic immigrants for more opportunities, business opportunities. In Karachi, the number of Pashtuns are in millions. Karachi is the biggest city of Pakistan, it's a port city. And if we see last year, there was a conflict between Pashtuns and refugees, MQM. There is an ethnic group in Pakistan which is called, they don't call them themselves anymore refugees, but the party, they have a political movement which is called MQM. Before it was a Mahajir Qaumi movement or refugee tribal movement, but now they call it United Tribal Movement, still MQM, Mutahida Qaumi Movement. Mutahida Qaumi Movement and the Pashtuns and other ethnic group has several conflicts in Karachi city, and a few times Pakistani government deployed the Pashtun militia from Frontier Corps to keep law and order in that region because it was so violent and they were burning each other's houses. So, but anyway, last year in the conflict, Pashtuns were able to defend themselves against MQM. So now you can see the number has been increased. The numbers are in millions. That's why they were able to defeat themselves against MQM. We have Afghan refugees, still more than 2 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan. And majority of these Afghan refugees are Pashtuns. People are calling about radicalism among the Pashtuns, for Pashtuns. They're calling Pashtuns extremists. I totally agree with that. Pashtuns are extremists. Pashtuns are radicals. But there are two types of radicalism and extremists in Pashtuns. One, having more than 60% of Pashtuns in Pakistan under control of Punjab, and we all know about situation in Pakistan, under control of the Pakistani army, and how Al-Qaeda, and having a huge influence of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. So there is no doubt that a portion of these Pashtuns will be trained, will be brainwashed, and will be used as an extremist, as insurgents, as a warriors, against coalition forces, against the Afghan government, against American forces in Afghanistan, for so many reasons. First reason, or the biggest reason for that will be stomach and hunger. Because Pashtuns are the least educated people in this world. And they don't have any life. And I'm always afraid of a person that who has nothing to lose. Because if he has nothing to lose, he can die for nothing, or he can kill for nothing. And other reason is that Pashtuns, they are extremists in their friendship. Once they become friends, then they don't care about themselves. They do care about the friendship becomes more bigger priority or a high priority than their own life. So that is another reason that some of the Pashtuns that they became friends to this radicalism or extremism, they are used against as in Afghanistan. The Pashtun, how they see today's conflict, and how do you see the Westerns in Afghanistan, or generally how do you see Westerns, how they view Westerns? There are two. We have it. Pre 2001 and post 2001. Before 2001, when Soviet invaded Afghanistan, first of all, let me put it this way: the Afghan Pashtuns, because of the history with English, with the British, their views about British was totally different. Their views about that and Pashtuns in Pakistan, who were part of the British India from 1893 till 1947, and then became part of today's Pakistan, they were very positive about British, about Westerns. But in Afghanistan, among the Pashtuns in Afghanistan, that was, there are two different ways. About Americans, Pashtuns were always positive. about British because of the history. There were some concerns. There were while you were reading the history books from the fifth grade in the school, you were always reading in the history books First War, Second War, Third War with British. If you go to Afghanistan and ask, I don't know how it is today, but at that time when I was in school, I learned about those fightings and wars in my fifth grade. I had all of the history in my fifth grade in that childhood. So if you are giving that mentality again to a child at that age, so of course that has negative effects. When the Afghan jihad or the holy war for the sake of God began in 1978-79, with the first in 78 with the communist coup of the Afghan communist two communist parties, and then followed by the direct invasion of the Soviet forces. I remember it. I remember the day when the coup happened. I remember the night when Soviet forces invaded Afghanistan. And I went through all this era of the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen were wearing, what was the uniform of Mujahideen? The U.S. Army jackets. The name tags were removed, but the U.S. Army was still there. In the beginning, they were supplied with AK-47 RPGs, and later on that went up to the Stinger missiles. So everybody knew that where the resources and where the funds and where the support is coming to us that while we are fighting with Soviet Union. So that developed a positive, even more positive mentality among the Pashtuns, among the Afghans, in regards to Americans. And how many of you watched the movie Charlie Wilson's War? Ladies and gentlemen, it's highly recommended movie that you watch it. It's a very good movie and a very good, you will learn a lot in that couple of hours about the history of Afghan-Soviet war. Finally, that support demised the Afghan communist regime in 2001, sorry, in 1992, and then the civil war era began, and finally, Taliban took over in 1996. But anyway, to make it short, in 2001, which is post-Taliban era, the Taliban government was dismissed. And since then, we have a huge presence of the foreign troops in Afghanistan, especially the U.S. troops. U.S. Army is toward RC east of Afghanistan, and Marine Corps are in the southern of Afghanistan. What brought this new era or this new changes to the people of Afghanistan? And there is a lot to say, but unfortunately the camera is there, and having a camera in front of me, I won't be able to say everything. The warlords who caused civil war in Afghanistan from 92 to 96, which killed only between 50,000 and 60,000 innocent people in the city of Kabul, when more than 10,000 underage children and women, boys and girls, children, when I'm talking, were raped, when 70% of the city of Kabul was destroyed, and when opportunity was given to birth of Taliban. So those warlords are sitting in today's government again. So that was the gift of these changes, and they were brought back to the government, and they were empowered. They were not as weak as they were before. They have weapons, they have army, resources, they have all types of resources today. And as a result of that, Talibans were stamped that Talibans are all Pashtuns. Every Pashtun is not Talib, but all Talibans are Pashtuns. I will disagree with that. Qari Taj Muhammad, one of the cabinet ministers of Taliban, who was a planning minister, who was Tajik from Badakhshan, he couldn't even speak Pashto language. He had always had an interpreter with him while he was communicating with other Pashtun Taliban leaders. A large number of Uzbeks, even personal security of Mullah Omar, they were Uzbeks from the north. Because Taliban movement was not a Pashtun movement. It was not a national movement. It was part of Al-Qaeda, as I said before. But based on that, Northern Alliance, even Northern Alliance was not purely Tajik or non-Pashtun alliance. large number of the members of the Northern Alliance who supported the U.S. mission. Actually, I put it the other way. People believe that the Northern Alliance supported U.S. mission in Afghanistan, but I say, I believe that U.S. supported the Northern Alliance to come to Kabul. Because Northern Alliance were living in the mountains, they cut all the supply routes, and they were somehow in a very terrible situation. They were just protecting themselves. They would never become able to defeat Taliban without U.S. support, without B-52. That was the most of the Afghan belief. So as a result of bringing the Northern Alliance members back to the city of Kabul and the defeat of Taliban, somehow gave a mentality, not a mentality, brought a situation that Pashtuns became second-class citizens in Afghanistan. In spite of having President Pashtun, in spite of having some representatives in the Afghan government, Pashtuns consider second-class citizens. That is the truth and that is the reality. Today, we have media. So Afghanistan never had such a huge media in the history of the country like we have it today. There are less than 20% publications in Pashto language. Always, there was a balance in the media, 50-50, 50% Pashto, 50% Dari. But today, less than 20% Pashto. When you are listening the meetings or the Congress of Afghanistan, you will hardly hear Pashto language in the Congress. Even the Pashtuns are talking Dari language to please the others, not to become target, because they're afraid. That's what the reality and the truth is. So based on all these facts, and the Pashtuns consider themselves not a first-class citizen, second-class citizen. Pashto language, which was a historical language, is a national language, has not been declared by the Constitution of 2003 as a national language. They added one more language to the official list, which is Uzbek language. So Pashto, Uzbek, and Dari are official languages, but there is no national language. The officer corps of Afghanistan, which was historically a Pashtun officer corps, and within the Pashtun, it was a Ghilzai officer corps, actually. Because Duranis, they had a very small representation in the officer corps. It was share of power between Duranis and Ghilzais and Karlanis. The officer corps was handed over to Ghilzais. And the Ghilzais were very happy and satisfied. That's why they did not oppose King Zahir Shah's in the 40 years. Because they had the guns and the weapon of control of the officer corps. How much we have today? You can hardly see. And the officer corps is completely different today. But anyway, these are becoming too much political. I'm going to skip that. Tribal leadership. Ladies and gentlemen, the tribal leadership before 1979 or 1978, before the communist era, even a number of you participated in the Emerald Express conference, and you heard Mr. Popal, the head of the local governance of Afghanistan, he said that there was a strong central government in Afghanistan, but meanwhile, there was an informal agreement with the locals, or contracts with locals. What was a strong central government in Afghanistan? What did he mean by that? I remember the strong central government in Afghanistan. My own district, 50 miles from the capital of Afghanistan, we had a representation of the government during the king's time. There was no place for the government officials to live. There was no place for the government officials to have their offices. I remember a tribal leader gave a house for their office. The same tribal leader gave houses to the district administrator and to the police chief to live in it. So now you see which one was powerful. It was not the government that they were supporting the people, or they were supporting these Pashtun tribes or elders. They were the Pashtun tribes and elders were supporting the government. They were actually ruling, making able the government to rule. I remember when two people were fighting, or there was a dispute over the land or something like that, when they were going to the district structure, district governor, chief of police, a sergeant with about two dozen police soldiers, and district judge. with a few clerks. That was the total district administration. Later on, in mid-70s, President Daoud made it luxury. He added a prosecutor also to the structure of the district governments. And it's still the same thing, not changed. So when two people were fighting and they were going to the government filing cases against each other, the government was not registering cases because for two reasons. One, they're advising those individuals to go back to the tribal leader, to Khan and Malik, to solve the problem traditionally in their own way. For two reasons. One, they did not want to give a sense or idea or kind of a mentality to the tribal elders that they are opposing their authority. Second, they didn't have capacity. They were not able to hand over all those cases. So they were trying to solve it locally and somehow keep themselves away from those issues and problems. Things were working. Tribal elders were never a threat to the government. They were always in support of government. They were always calling, we have a term in Pashto which is called Ashar. Ashar means, it's a very important part of the Pashtun code of honor. Ashar means voluntarism. For example, when the government wanted to have roads, they never built roads. The Khans and the Maliks, they were calling for voluntarism. They were calling on those young men in the villages, in the valleys, in the areas under their control, and they were cooking food or lunches for them, and people were coming working 10 hours, 12 hours a day, free of charge, without any cost, just for that one food, and plus because they were ordered or they were requested by Khans. And then they were obliged to that because that announce of Ashar, then they were sending those messages of voluntarism to them. In 1979, when Soviet invaded Afghanistan and the Charlie Wilson War began, and the Holy War for the sake of God began, two communist parties were in Afghanistan. Both leaders of the communist parties were Pashtuns. The majority numbers of the because Pashtuns are more, they're more in everywhere. They are more in good people and they are more in bad people. It was very difficult because one brother was a communist, part of the communist party, and one was not. It was very difficult to convince one brother to go and fight with his brother or kill his brother. So what happened, the flow of migration started. Afghan refugees migrated to Pakistan. In Pakistan, 70 factions were established. These are 1979's data, close between 65 and 70. I don't have the exact numbers. Pakistani government or Pakistani army selected six of them and shut down the rest of them. All six of them were religious leaders. After a couple of years, one more, which is Professor Sayaf, the current parliamentarian with the 2 feet long beard, he was added also to that list. So that became seven, because he was originally he was in jail in Kabul. So given the leadership of the war against Soviet forces in Afghanistan, actually empowered the leadership. And they made that war a religious war or holy war against infidel communists. And that gave permit or permission to everyone to become, what was that, James Bond, license to kill. So every individual who was part of the Mujahideen was licensed to kill. There was no accountability. Nobody was responsible. Why you killed that person? He was a communist. Go ahead, kill your cousin for land. Why you kill him? He was a communist. Kill your enemy, kill someone for his wife, kill someone for his money. Why you kill him? He was a communist. So these millions of Afghans were licensed to kill. And that situation empowered the religious leadership and weakened the tribal leadership. So this is today the situation. Today we are dealing with the religious leaders. They are heads of the insurgencies. They are part of the very important in the parliament. They are majority members of the parliament. They are in the cabinet. They are in the government. They are everywhere. So can we go back to the previous system? It's impossible. I won't say it's impossible, but it's very difficult. So somehow, diplomacy is needed to empower the tribal leadership, and gradually their rise will somehow reduce the authority of the religious leadership by itself, because the people, the Pashtuns, are not loyal to the religious leaders. They are afraid of them. They don't like them by heart. They are afraid of them. For example, today we have Sher Muhammad Akhundzada in Helmand province. Can anybody oppose Sher Muhammad Akhundzada? Sher Muhammad Akhundzada's uncle was Nasim Akhundzada. His father was Rasul Akhundzada. They didn't let anybody in the province who was opposing them. So can the people of Helmand, can the tribal elders in Helmand oppose him? No, because he has power, he has resources. It is very difficult to change the system overnight. Importance of Pashtun Wali. Ladies and gentlemen, we keep hearing, sometimes we hear that Pashtun Wali is not important, and Pashtun Wali has been weakened in the last 30 years of conflict. But if I am asking me that question, I will say Pashtun Wali has been promoted in the last 30 years of war, because there was no government, even that weak central government we had, that was demised and destroyed. So in the last 30 years, in spite of having these heavily involvement of the religious leaders, having Islamic law, Sharia law from 96 to 2001, Pashtun Wali was the only law in the rules and regulation which governed the Pashtuns. The Pashtun Wali is not something that I can talk about that in 5 minutes, because we have another presentation about that. So is Pashtun Wali a long-term solution? No. Pashtun Wali is never a long-term solution. What is required is to somehow educate the people of Afghanistan to move towards constitutionalization. So we need to take them out of the tribal system and move them towards, or they need to be moved towards political movements. Today, after 8-9 years of having a government fully backed up by international community and US forces, Hamid Karzai couldn't make political party. There is no one political party. There is no opposition party. There is no ruling party. All these what you have is the product of Pakistan or the Afghan-Soviet war. Or before that, the Afghan Communist parties or the Afghan Nation Party and something like that. Can Pashtuns work with the rest of the world based on their tribal system? It is impossible. You can see the image of Bacha Khan. Bacha Khan was sitting in the Bonn Agreement or in the Bonn meeting in 2001. But there was a lack of communication, because the people who were coming from international community, the United Nations, US government and other forces, countries, they couldn't understand what Bacha Khan is saying, and Bacha Khan was not able to understand them. So therefore, again, education is needed. And once they become education, and they will properly communicate with the rest of the world and international community, and that will be the solution. Pashtuns don't want fight. They are tired of fight on both sides. Pashtuns in Pakistan, Pashtuns in Afghanistan. What they want survival, they want food, they want something to live on it. But one thing that they definitely want is that is an honor to them. They will never compromise with anybody, with anything, on their language and on their culture. That's the only thing that they have nothing. The same houses that 300 years ago their grandfathers had, it, they are living in the same houses, mud houses. The same cow from the dairy product, or the same piece of land. But their honor is their code of honor, their culture, and their language. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You've opened up many questions. As chair, I'll take the privilege of asking you one question, which you mentioned about the relationship of Mullah Omar and the Taliban being part of Al-Qaeda. As recently, if you look at both Mullah Omar and his associates within the Taliban, their rhetoric seems to be more nationalistic. My question to you is whether this is a tactic that they are doing in order to be reintegrated, or is this a change of heart? To read, I would say about the last year and a half or two, most of, not Haig, nor Haqqani, but we call the QSD, the Quetta Shura Taliban. It sounds very much like, they say we are not interested in anything, as you said, international. We are interested only in Afghan issues, and we don't want to be basically part of an international movement. You think they're sincere, or this is just a tactic? Thank you.
Thank you, Sir Kutarzi. I feel more comfortable when I'm standing. I got used with the Marine Corps system. Without PowerPoint and without standing, I can't function. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very good question. When Taliban took over, I go a little again, as in Afghans go back to Alexander the Great era. When Taliban took over the eastern region of Afghanistan, Nangarhar province in September 1996, head of the Taliban movement was Mullah Burjan. Mullah Burjan was, in the way Mullah Burjan was operating, when the Mujahideen commanders were hearing name of Mullah Burjan, they were just quitting. They were not fighting. They were just leaving. So when Mullah Burjan very successfully took care of the eastern part of Afghanistan, then he moved towards Kabul. On the way to Kabul, he decided once he get to Kabul, he will save Dr. Najibullah, the last communist president of Afghanistan, who was in the United Nations office, and his brother also. But he heard that a group has been assigned that they will go and kill Dr. Najibullah. And he opposed that decision. He opposed that. He said, no, I promised Dr. Najibullah, he is a Pashtun leader, and I'm going to protect him. So what happened before Mullah Burjan gets to Kabul, in Sarubi, there is a small area which is called Tangi Abrasion or Abrasion Pass. In that Abrasion Pass, Mullah Burjan was killed in night time. He was killed by his supporters, his own people, and he was wrapped in his blanket and put his body on the side where he was buried in the same spot. But his truck, his four-wheel drive truck, was leading the battle. And then they gave the message to the people of Kabul or to the Ahmad Shah Massoud's government that Mullah Burjan is coming. And that empty truck took control of the Kabul city. But he was killed. And later on, Mullah Rabbani, who was assigned as a head of the caretaking government of Taliban, because the Supreme Council of Taliban, they did not move from Kandahar to Kabul. They remained in Kandahar, Mullah Omar. Mullah Rabbani was in Kabul. Mullah Rabbani was also a very liberal and nationalist individual. And after some time, when he opposed the decisions of Taliban Supreme Council, and he opposed the decisions of Al-Qaeda, and for some time, they say that Mullah Rabbani is sick, and then he died. And the rumors were that he was given poison. So what I see is, coming back to your question, Taliban are not agree on what Mullah Omar and Al-Qaeda is doing in Afghanistan from the very beginning. The only there are two factions, and there are different factions today. So Taliban, we have the foreign minister of Taliban today in Afghan government. He's supporting our peace process. So I think that portion of Taliban are very nationalistic. They're based on their patriotism, because that the Pashtun Wali, the Afghanization is becoming more stronger than Talibanization or their loyalty to Al-Qaeda, and that is leading them towards reintegration.
Thank you. The call is open to questions. Please identify yourself and wait for that microphone to come to you. Please.
Thank you. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Roger Cooper Simpson from the UK. And I'd like to ask a question about the Afghan National Army, which you mentioned. You mentioned the makeup of the officer corps as part of your talk. When I was working with the Afghan National Army, a number of officers I spoke to were very passionate about how the army was the only pan-national organization in Afghanistan, made up, of course, of all the different ethnic, well, not all of them, but a good number of them. And I felt that this is really, really very important as part of the structure of the new states, the emerging new states of Afghanistan. Do you think it's a genuine and realistic aspiration, by which I mean, can the Pashtuns in that officer corps and in the army in general really support the army above the more narrow passion and loyalties that they may feel? That's my first question. And also, a question really about the ability of the Afghan National Army to enforce security, to fight, really, in Pashtun areas. I wonder if you had any views about whether Pashtun soldiers working for the central government can fight effectively, or if you think they can. I've seen them fight quite effectively in many cases, but I'd be interested to know what your perspective is about Pashtuns fighting Pashtuns, you know, Taliban and other insurgents in Pashtun areas. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. It is very clear that the Afghan National Army is the only national institution in the country, or put it this way, the most credible or effective national institution in the country. When these officers are talking with you, as a member of NATO forces, their supporter, their donor, they're diplomat. They're not as open as they're talking to me, or they're talking to Dr. Tarzi. Because Afghans are very diplomat, especially the Pashtuns, they always have been in between two superpowers. They are illiterate. Most of them cannot read and write. But once you sit with them, their public diplomacy is very, it's part of their life. I think, and that's what I heard, that they are supportive, or that they are supporters of the process, they are supporters and strong believers of a strong army in Afghanistan, but they feel, I go back to my second-class citizens, they consider themselves second-class citizens, even within the army. And coming back to your second question, the tribal composition, or the criteria which is established, says that there has to be 46% Pashtuns, 25% Tajiks, 13 Hazaras, 10 Uzbeks, and so on. They are following the criteria, they are following the numbers, but 46% are all soldiers in the lower ranking. That number has to be followed, or they have to somehow consider that on the higher level, on the officer level. In the area where we have insurgency, especially in the south and southeast part of Afghanistan, we don't only need Pashtun soldiers, we need their Pashtun officers, Pashtun commanders. For example, if you go back to the newly established Corps 215, how difficult it was for Hamid Karzai to decide who will be the Corps commander. President was involved, Parliament was involved. And he finally refused every proposal, and he said, no, this is a Pashtun seat, Pashtun area, I have to have a Pashtun commander in this area. And that's the new commander of the newly established corps is a Pashtun brigadier general. The area, the terrain is very important. Why Marines are going through Bridgeport trainings? Why they go through Mojave Viper trainings? To become familiar with the area, with the terrains. My question is that the people from the north, the people from the central part of Afghanistan, while they cannot even communicate languages, Pashtuns in the Paktika, Khost, Helmand, how many of them can speak Dari language? How many of them can speak Uzbek language? If they cannot communicate properly, how can they be effective in those areas? In today's situation, in today's this conflict, we have a term in Pashto, we said, iron can break an iron. Pashtuns will break, Pashtun Afghan army members will break today's Pashtun insurgents in Afghanistan. I hope it makes sense to you, but it makes perfect sense in Afghanistan.
Good afternoon. My name is Monica Robbins. I teach counterterrorism analysis for the Army Intelligence and Security Command. You spoke earlier about you believe that a lot of the solution to the larger problem is empowering the tribes. So I was wondering if you had any recommendations for specific strategies that could be used to do that.
Well, ma'am, thank you for your question. Today, if you go to Afghanistan, everyone is tribal leader, because everywhere, most people have the access to the resources that the people of Afghanistan, some individual has today, they never had it in their life. So when you go, for example, to a province, to a district, you will see people with some shiny beards, Land Cruisers, bodyguards, and they will be pretending that they are leaders. But in reality, they are not leaders. So first of all, we need to distinguish dealers from leaders. Who are the dealers and who are the leaders? Because the dealers in the last 30 years, they are very expert. They became, everyone is a PhD, a double PhD in his profession. Because they were dealing with Russians, Soviets, they were dealing with Al-Qaeda, they were dealing with Mujahideen, and today they are dealing with coalition forces. They are very smart, they know how to make money, and how to convince you what he or they are telling to you that is correct and true, because they have the expertise. In irrigation projects, when an engineer is going to do a survey somewhere, a project, construction project, concrete project related to water, I don't know about the here in the U.S., but in Afghanistan, they are doing 30 years of background check of that region or that area or that flood area. In the U.S., when you purchase houses, the title company goes 40 years, they do title search 40 years. And I think that is one of the mechanisms that we can use it to do a search, 30 to 40 years of search, that what this individual was 30 years ago. Because tribal leadership is not by money. Tribal leadership is not something which has been granted to someone. It comes through hierarchy. There is no doubt, people say that the tribal leaders are all dead. No one is living because of the war. Their sons are living, their grandsons are living. They have the same influence like their fathers and grandfathers, but they are weak.
Any more questions?
I'll raise a question. I'm Max Gross, teaching at Georgetown University
now. Here, courtesy is a friend of Amin. 25 years ago, I was in Afghanistan, and I was asked by a scholar, when I went back to the States, would I provide some literature back to him about how you create a modern state on the basis of a traditional tribal society. And we have examples of Germany and in many other states. It's been a very long evolutionary process. What I've discovered is there's very little literature. It's not something that's studied very much. When you have the traditional tribal structure that you've been talking about, even though it is gravely weakened, and I suppose we could say eroded, and yet Afghanistan is in the process of somehow becoming a modern state, where the state has individual relationship with the individuals, citizens of that society, as opposed to going through intermediaries. Have you given thought, this is a dilemma, how do we get beyond, the inertia of the tribal society, into a more modern constitutional society, which Afghanistan needs to achieve these aims that you outlined at the end, elimination of poverty and peace. And is my question clear enough?
Yes, it's my personal opinion that we can get to that stage through the tribal leaders. Working with tribal leaders, working with tribes, working with individuals in the tribe doesn't mean that we are empowering them to take over. But this is a solution. This is the only, how can you, for example, in the last 8 years, the whole world is trying to establish a very good government in Afghanistan. Hundreds of billions of dollars has been spent so far on building a government in Afghanistan. Which type of government Afghanistan has? One of the most corrupted government and the weak government governments in the world. And what is the reason? Because the reason is that we are focused on building a government, not building a nation. How can you build a nation while you work with local population? How can you get access to the local population directly? It is very difficult to deal with 30 million people individually. So the tribal leadership or the tribal leaders are facilitators. They are not that we will empower them and they will take over, they will become a threat to the government or a threat in the long term. The tribal leadership are just playing a role of facilitators. They will be honored while we approach them, and they will feel ownership in the process, and that their honor and their ownership will give us an opportunity to get to the local to the bottom level or to the local population, so we can educate them or provide them at least opportunity for more education to get out the country from the tribal system to a constitutionalization. I hope.
So
that's what King Zahir Shah did. That's what we had a strong, that we call it strong central government of Afghanistan. King Zahir Shah was not empowering the tribal leaders. So he was taking advantage of their resources.
More questions? Yes, please.
Sorry, forgive me asking a second question, but I'm interested in your views on democracy as it's practiced in Afghanistan at the moment. The presidential elections last year, of course, had all sorts of problems, at least problems as seen from the West, and there's parliamentary elections coming up, of course. What's your perspective on these? Will they serve to damage the emerging strengthening of the tribal system? Will we ever get the right people elected to represent those tribes through a parliamentary democratic election system? How do you see democracy panning out? And is democracy the right thing to be using or encouraging, certainly at the parliamentary level in Afghanistan at the moment?
What I believe is that democracy is a solution, and democracy, if you go to the history of Afghanistan, for the first time in this, what you call it, 3,000 years of history, 5,000 years of history, 500 years of history, for the first time, Afghans voted. There was voting, last voting was in 70s, in late 60s actually, during King Zahir Shah's time, but that was only for the members of the parliament or for member of the Congress, not for, because it was a kingdom. For the president, for the first time they voted. They voted for, not only for president, they voted for the members of the parliament as well as for the members of the provincial councils. And they are moving towards voting for their district councils, even village level. Everybody loved democracy, everybody wants democracy. But here, survival is on the one side, democracy is on the other side. So which one is more, what I see is survival, well, if you better survive, you will move toward democracy. If you don't survive, how can you get to the democracy? That is one. And second, in regarding to the elections that you see the problems in the election process is not only a one-way problems that we can blame the Afghan government for that. You can blame them the way you want, and they can be blamed. The problem is not only, the problem is on the other hand also. For example, it was very clear, and before the parliamentary election of last parliamentary election, I met with some of the individuals. They say that it has been many, many times mentioned that Afghanistan's president shouldn't expect such a great parliament. This is a baby democracy, and we will get a kind of different types of the parliament, and gradually it will improve. But I can tell you that the next parliamentary election will be much better than what we had last time, because last time people they didn't have an idea what they are doing, how they are voting, where they are voting. I hope the international partners also do their job, because I remember it was on a BBC news report that last parliamentary election, United Nations admitted that they fired 50 of their employees by involving corruption, supporting some of the individuals here and there by voting. It was a BBC report that the United Nations committed. So I hope, and then It took 3 months. That was a question. That is a question with every Afghan. That why it took 3 months to count the votes. So what Afghan believe that in 3 months a lot of deals has been made. So I hope this time the international partners also focus on that. But the people of Afghanistan are eager for democracy.
This question has to do with your historical background about the Pashtuns being descendants of Bene Israel. It's, I've read this and I've heard this and I know about it. But I have a question. Another part of this history should be linguistic. And I don't understand how a Semitic people, the Hebrews, who later became influenced by the Arabs, another Semitic people with Islam, became an Aryan-speaking people.
You mean the Pashto language?
Pashto language, right.
Pashto language is believed that this is the... Afghanistan is one of the members of the... founder member of the United Nations. And when Pashto language was recommended by the Afghan government to the United Nations to put it in the list of the languages, it was denied. Because the language was so incomplete. There were a lot of terminologies. There were very small vocabulary. So after that, the Afghan government, so they worked through the academics, through the Kabul University and some linguists, they made terminologies. For teacher, for instructor, for driver, for school, for this and that. So somehow they met the requirement of the United Nations so they can put Pashto language in the list of the United Nations languages approved by the United Nations. Pashto is believed that this is a language of intelligence during King Solomon Prophet Solomon. That he was communicating by this language with Asif and Afaghina. Afaghina was, as I said, his head of the army, and Asif was his prime minister. So this was a secret language between Prophet Solomon and Asif and Afaghina, who was the genealogy of the Pashtun Ghuz, or who were the grandsons of King Saul. That's what I know, and I have that's information I have. And gradually that became the language of the Pashtuns who migrated to or those Bani Israelis who migrated to the Ghor.
If nobody else is there, I have a question on the same issue because I have read it from the British sources in the 18th century mainly. I personally find it hard to believe. Whenever I go to Israel, I joke with them. I say, you know what, I'm a Levite. Please give me my share of land. But language is a very good thing that we heard from Professor Gross, because there are certain basics of languages. When you look at Hebrew, Arabic, they're very similar, whereas the Aryan or Indo-Iranian languages have basic ideas. Words like brother, mother, in Persian, as you know, is pradar, madar, in Pashto is more, which is all shows the same linkage. But it does not have Hebrew or Arabic or any Semitic signage in it. So I think the question, I'm just pushing that question a little bit further, is why are not there any of those basics? We know basics, as I say, there's mother, father, brother, daughter, Pashto, English, Persian, they all sound the same. The word bad, same thing. But you don't see any of the Hebrew or Arabic languages coming into Pashto. So, because I personally, this theory is one of the more exciting theories about the Pashtuns, which I always have looked at it more as a... I just learned something today from your lecture. I thought this was more of a British anthropological
endeavor, and then it was just kind of dismissed. But if you elaborate on it a bit more, we'd appreciate that.
Well, Dr. Taizi, what you mentioned has, if we talk about Dari language, Farsi language, yes, that has a lot in common with English language. For example, you talk about mother, brother. But brother in English, brother in Dari. Gurur in Pashto. There is nothing in common between Roar and brother and brother. Mor, mother or mother. But if you are talking, I guess, about ma sound in Urdu language or Hindi languages, which are Sanskrit languages, they also call it ma. I don't see any shared vocabulary or terms in between Pashto and the other Aryan languages like you just mentioned. As I said before, Pashto language was a very small language, it was not a complete language, and later on, by time, they adopted some vocabularies from other languages to make it complete for use. I hope that makes sense to you, that Pashto is, I'm teaching Pashto language. I developed Pashto grammar, and Pashto grammar has nothing in common with other Aryan languages' grammars.
Well, we are basically at the end of our talk. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're busy. He travels more often than anybody I know. He goes everywhere and talks to Marines from literally four corners of the globe, even even in Georgia. So thank you for taking this much time from us, for your schedule to give to us. And also we look forward to your paper, which I think will enhance, as I said in the beginning, what we are trying to give you is different perspectives about the very same people. I think one thing we often make a mistake, in my view, is to look at Pashtuns in a very homogenic, this is one thing, you know, a cookie cutter. We know it, but yet we still look at it. I think hopefully by the end of this series, at least in our capacity here within the Marine Corps University's community, bring the idea that you walk out of here about the differences, the narratives. You are now already have heard three different, if you've been here with us all three times, three different versions of the same story. And it's which one is right? They're all right. Which one, you know, each one has components of what is acceptable. And for us as a whole to make a policy, I think understanding those would be very good in order to move forward. With that, we are very grateful to you. And I will say one thing, if all immigrants in this country can speak like you, we're in a very good position. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For further information, please contact Dr. Amin Tarzi, Director of Middle East Studies at tarzia@grc.usmcu.edu or Adam C. Seitz, Senior Research Associate, Middle East Studies at seitzac.usmcu.edu.